Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening this morning. In this first hour of the program, we'll be talking about Turkey, about Turkish politics, about a number of things, including the interest in Turkey in joining the European Union. And we have two guests with us here in the studio who have been following Turkey and Turkish politics for a long time. They're both here visiting the campus to take part in a symposium. This is the second Turkish Studies Symposium that's taking place today on the U of I campus. And it is sponsored by the Program in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. And our guests are Rajat Kasaba. He is professor in the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. And Binaz Toprak, professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, in Turkey. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, you should certainly feel free to join the conversation. The only thing we ask of people who call is that people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
For being here. We certainly appreciate it. Well, the point that I thought we might start with is to talk a little bit about Turkey's interest in joining the EU. This is a process that's now underway, will take some time, a decade, I gather, at least. And I think there are some people who think that by the time that all said and done, if Turkey is admitted, it might be as late as 2020. But somewhere between 2015 and 2020. Perhaps you could start and talk a little bit about why it is Turkey would want to join. And maybe Professor Binaz might, or Professor Toprak might like to begin.
Well, I guess you would have to go back to history to answer that question, because Turkey, for at least the last 200 years, has been trying to be part of the Western world. The whole process started, as it did in many other countries that were late developers, such as Russia, China, Japan, and so on. The whole process of Westernization started in the 19th century during the Ottoman period, but it gained momentum with the Republic, which was established in 1923. And I think the Republican semi-ideology was Westernization, to take Turkey out of its Islamic Ottoman past and integrated with the Western world. And indeed, when you look at the history of the Republic, and especially its foreign policy, Turkey has always situated itself within the Western alliance. During the Cold War years, for example, it was an ally of the U.S. and Western camp, and is part of the original agenda of the framers of the Republic that Turkey would integrate with the West rather than be part of the Middle Eastern world. And I think the EU process is a culmination of that agenda, or culmination of that vision on the part of Ottoman and later Turkish statesmen and intellectuals.
Hmm. Well, I'll turn to Professor Kasaba and maybe frame the question just slightly differently. Partly then, it's a sense that Turkey always has had this identification with the West. And that, certainly there must be very concrete sort of benefits that people in Turkey feel will accrue. Economic ones, I would think, would be at the top of the list.
Yes. It is true that Turkey, at some point in its history, did make a decision to cast its lot with the West, specifically with Europe. And the consequences of that has been many. Politically, Turkey is part of many of the alliances that are centered in Europe, including NATO. Mm. And today, most of Turkey's major trading partners are European countries. There are upwards of 3 million Turks who are living and working in various countries in Europe. And not being part of these new arrangements that come with European Union puts Turkey in a relatively disadvantageous position in negotiating its future economic plans and relationships with countries. So there are some basic material factors, too, in addition to the overall orientation of the country's cultures and political priorities towards West and Europe. Usually, Turkey is thought of as a country that it straddles East and West, and that is something people always talk about, Turkey as a bridge. But for most Turks, it's more the West than the East, the overall orientation of the country, its educational system, its future plans have always been looking towards the West. So it's a, and it's something that was taken for granted during most of the Cold War. With the changes after the end of the Cold War, there has been new possibilities, new openings, but that has also brought new questions about the exact place of Turkey in that part of the world.
Yeah. And maybe if I could add on the economy part, I think that process has even accelerated since 1980 when Turkey made this important transition from import substitution industrialization to a free market economy. And since then, and especially now, since, let's say, the beginning of the 21st century, the years that start with 2000, Turkey has been very rapidly integrating with world markets and with the global economy. Just last year, for example, it achieved a growth rate that was higher than China, which is almost miraculous, especially if you consider the fact that it just went out of a very severe economic crisis that erupted in, was it in 2001. So I think, and I, what was perhaps more interesting is that a group of new entrepreneurs in small Anatolian towns have entered into the picture in addition to the old business establishment. There are now these giant firms in Anatolia, basically founded by very conservative, parochial, small town and religious people. They're called the Muslim Anatolian tigers, and in many ways they are, because they export, and these are global exporting businesses which are, you know, multi-billion dollar enterprises. So I think when you take all of that into account, from an economic point of view, people are very well aware that in a globalized world, if you're isolated, if you're not part of that whole globalization process, and especially if you're not part of some kind of a of an economic area, such as NAFTA in North America, for example, or Asian countries, that is difficult to proceed. So I think membership in the European Union at the same time means that Turkish economy will grow, and my suspicion is that that's one of the major reasons why, for example, the majority of the Turkish people want to join the EU, because they're very well aware that it's going to bring economic advantages.
Well, I'm interested in also in the reaction, what you can say about how people in Turkey react to how many Europeans react to the idea. Now, I'm not sure how systematic a survey has been done in Europe, but there certainly seem to be some people who have reasons for not wanting Turkey to join, and some of them have to do with concerns of people coming in and taking European jobs. They have to do with immigration. But one of the things that struck me, and particularly given this, you're talking about the fact that a lot of people in Turkey tend to identify perhaps more with Europe than they do with Asia, that there are people in Europe that say they don't think it's a good idea for Turkey to join because they don't think Turkey is European. Obviously, in Europe, they see Turkey, in a sense, facing the other direction as more of part of Asia rather than as part of Europe. And there seems to be this view of Turkey as the other. So not like us. They're different. How do people in Turkey feel when they hear that? And I'm sure that they do hear that those kind of comments coming from Europe.
I think European Union as a project since its beginning, I think is one of the most important and imaginative projects that to come out of the post-World War international system. This is a project that deliberately aims to undermine state sovereignty and create new institutions that cut across national boundaries and create new ways of organizing relationships among people, among states. And this, of course, at the beginning, there was a lot of hope in this, in Europe, too. This was seen as the new future, and there was tremendous support for the continuing expansion of this. It's interesting that in 1978, it was Turkey, actually, that froze the relations between Turkey and European Union because of some domestic economic concerns, which caused a lot of unhappiness in Europe because it was assumed that this was a system that would continue to grow like that. But now, partly as a result of what else is going on in the world, as the European Union expands, people in Europe are starting to see that this was, in fact, a new system. Now, for peasants living in southern Italy, the authority is no longer Rome, but Brussels. So they have to deal with Brussels when they have a problem with their some kind of economic issue. And as the system brings, of course, this brings a lot of insecurity for people. And there is a trend in Europe, not only in relationship to Turkey's membership, but in overall issues that have to do with European Union, towards more nationalism, more protectionism, being more closed, and not being that excited about having new members, again, not only Turkey, but also the former members of the Warsaw Pact. So I think this is an issue in Europe, too, and there are some politicians in Europe who don't think about Europe as much as they think about their national issues now. And Angela Merkel in, I think, Germany is a good example. It's a very skillful politician, but her concerns are more with Germany than with European Union. Now, in Turkey, too, there are domestic politicians and groups who are equally unhappy about the possibility of Turkey becoming part of a big system like that. This is not a majority, but an influential group of people who are very much interested in taking advantage of this negative reaction in Europe and, in fact, making it more difficult for Turkey to become part of the European Union and seek other arrangements. They can be Islamic, they can be more nationalistic, they can be more close to the rest of the world. And it serves the expressions of strong reaction or resistance against Turkey's membership serves the interests of these more what I would call conservative, close-minded groups in Turkey. And that would actually, that would be bad not only for Turkey, but for the region and for European interests in the region and for also the American interests in the region.
Mm. And actually, I mean, I would add that it serves the interests of conservatives in Europe, too,
okay,
because Europe itself is divided between, let's say, those who believe in that European ideal of a multicultural society without really state borders, which is an area of peace and democracy and liberalism and so on. And then all of these xenophobes, the right parties in Europe, such as Le Pen, let's say, you know, in France, or the skinheads in Germany, and you know, you have them in other countries as well, who are very much parochial, who are against this notion of Europe as a multicultural arena, who would like to keep Europe for Europeans only, who're scared of foreigners, and so on and so forth. So I think the more responsible statesmen, and unfortunately Christian Democrats partially serve that purpose as well, because, you know, Merkel is one example, but other Christian Democratic leaders I think, feel the same. And in fact, in a Congress some years ago, they specifically stated that Europe is Christian and it will remain Christian, and that a Muslim country has no place in it, which runs totally counter to the idea of Europe as it is being constructed, and I think to the Enlightenment notion of a secular Europe. So in many ways, I think this kind of anti-Turkish atmosphere, both in Europe and in Turkey, sort of strengthens the hands of those who are against the establishment of a more multicultural liberal democracy in the European continent. Mm.
Let me just introduce again both of the guests for anyone who might have tuned in here in the last 5 minutes or so. The last voice you heard belongs to Binaz Toprak. She's professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul. Also here at the table with us, Rashad Gazaba is professor in the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington. And both of them are here visiting the campus to take part in a symposium. This is the second Turkish Studies Symposium sponsored by the Programs in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. If you have questions, people who are listening certainly have questions. You can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The process, the conversation, the discussion between the EU and Turkey has now been going on for several years, mm-hmm. and the EU has said to Turkey, as it would say to any country that was asking to join, well, there are certain things we expect you to do in order to qualify. And changes have already been made in Turkey, so that sound to me like some fairly significant ones. Are there ways in which already life in Turkey has changed simply because it has entered into this process, which I suppose we should say there's also no guarantee that Turkey will become part of the EU? There may be some uncertainty there, but clearly already things have changed as a result.
It's actually the process of Turkey's eventual membership negotiations started in 1959. So we're talking about not months after the predecessor of European Union was established, mm-hmm. Turkey submitted its application, and the negotiations have been going on for that long period of time. In 1991, the European Union came up with a new set of criteria for dealing with these new countries who wanted to become a member. This was a reaction to the end of the Cold War primarily. And those requirements at the time really put major hurdles in the way of countries like Turkey in terms of changing their legal systems and economic systems and mostly bringing their institutions and laws in line with the European norms. After a 10-year of hesitation in early 2002, and between then and now, altogether I think 6 or 7 reform packages have been approved in the parliament in Turkey. And these changes go all the way from regulating the packaging of products to ending death penalty, bringing new reforms in dealing with court cases, introducing new freedoms in terms of minority rights in parts of Turkey, especially in relationship to Kurdish community. And these have, of course, changed life in Turkey in terms of affecting what people do and how they do, but also what they see on their televisions and how court cases are handled and how people's hopes and aspirations are about their future. Institutional changes, especially when they come so fast in a short period of time and they're immediately implemented, they do affect people's lives, and it has changed. And
funny enough, just to add to that list, as you know, we have this Justice and Development Party in power right now. And the origins of these people go back to the Islamic movement of the 80s and 70s. And yet this is a pro-EU political party that wants to consolidate democracy in Turkey. And since they came to power, I mean, it's a great irony of history, considering the very radical secularism of the Republic, that it should be this party that's leading the pro-European Union forces in Turkey right now. And also tells a lot about how exceptional the Turkish case might be from other Muslim countries. But since 2002, when you look at the list of what was done, like Reshat said, first of all, there were a number of changes in terms of extending basic rights of freedoms, especially freedom of speech, which recently has been problematic because of the way that article has been formulated in the criminal code, but that's a different story. But more importantly, perhaps, in terms of curbing the power of the military over civilian politics, much has been done on that issue. For example, the likelihood of a military coup in Turkey in the future, short of some terrible disaster, I would say, is right now almost zero. And both the military budget as well as policy is much more under the compared to the past, under civilian control now than used to be the case. But also a new civil code has been enacted by this government, for example, that conforms to all of the demands of the various feminist organizations in the country. I mean, we did have a civil code, and it was a secular civil code, but there were a number of articles there that were problematic. That civil code went back to the 1920s. And the new civil code does establish gender equality. One major problem with all of this, however, is implementation, of course. I mean, when you look at laws, there's very little there against freedom of speech, and yet there have been cases in recent months of courts sort of interpreting the law in very conservative ways so that people, for example, have been tried for something that they've said that was found contrary to the unity of the republic. But also, I think, in terms of more freedom to ethnic minorities, for example, the fact that the Kurds can now have education in Kurdish and have their own radio and TV stations and so on. These are really radical changes for Turkey, and it is a much more open society than it used to be in the past.
We have a couple of callers here. Why don't we bring them into the conversation,
okay,
starting with someone who is here local, both of them actually local, someone here in Champaign County on our line one. Hello.
Thank you. I was going to ask about U.S. I hope I still can, but on this point of the reforms versus for the civil code or the rights of women, did this cause a lot of schism inside of the ruling party, or was that not controversial inside the party itself, or... What do you think? Is it fatal to them in any way, or is it just? Do you get my drift? I mean,
yeah. As far as I know, there wasn't much of a debate. In other words, they didn't pass easily, obviously, because some of these demands by women's organizations were very radical, especially for a Muslim society. For instance, the new civil code recognizes marital rape. Now, for the ruling party, which, after all, is made up of people who come from very conservative and religious backgrounds, where the notion of the family is sacrosanct, it is a radical move to accept an article like that in the civil code. And there are other articles of that type. For example, in the old civil code, the husband was considered to be the head of the family. That's no longer the case in the new one. So in many ways, I think the new civil code has conformed to women's expectations, except for a few articles that were unable to pass. Now, that doesn't mean that the present party were was happy with all of them. For example, right before the European Union in December 2005 was going to give a date to Turkey to start negotiations, which was a very important time, the ruling party came up with the suggestion, the civil code had not passed then, that adultery would be punishable by a prison sentence. I mean, this was crazy, and it caused an uproar in Europe as well as an uproar within Turkey by feminist organizations as well as the media, not just the feminist organizations. I mean, luckily they dropped it, but this only shows that there is, of course, some kind of attention there. One thing they need to do, in my opinion, is to accept quotas for women in parliament. And the present AKP is very much resistant to that idea, arguing that women should deserve it and should come to political positions by their own power rather than through quotas. Eventually, I think they will have to accept it because this is going to be on the agenda of the European Union, and sooner or later, they will pass this quota law because that's how it was solved in every country, including all-time democratic countries like France. You know, France had very few people in its National Assembly, and it was thanks to the women's quota that it was increased.
Hmm. I thought that was done sort of an internal policy party rating of the list, but anyway, I guess it was a, at some level a national policy. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to ask about was the biggest schism in U.S. Turkish relations was the non-cooperation with the invasion of Iraq, and I know that something like 90% of Turkish people didn't want to participate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were being told that this was for democracy, and Wolfowitz, who knows Turkey quite well, I think, you know, is notorious for supposedly being an advocate of this, but when, well, that's history, but I think it's worth noting and mentioning. And the thing that I want to know is, at the same time, the U.S. has been sort of a vocal proponent of Turkish accession to the European Union. But you don't. I don't hear much about that of late, and I'm wondering whether they're just told that they're being too, that it doesn't serve even Turkey well to be that, that kind of strong arm rhetoric to be happening. It's not terribly diplomatic to be so insistent in that way. That they should do that behind closed doors. But I'm wondering whether there's not inside the U.S. Disagreement on whether that's a good idea or not now, and whether maybe that's why they don't seem to be as strong an advocate of accession to the European Union. Hmm. And I guess I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. I think we have to kind of see that there has been a change in terms of U.S. foreign policy towards Turkey's relationship with Europe and Turkey's place in the Middle East between Clinton administration and the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. In theory, I think Bush administration is also still supportive of Turkey's membership in the European Union. But there is, in Turkey, there is a perception that a closer alliance with U.S. as opposed to with Europe will put Turkey in a different position in the region. So that, I think, is an important issue. And Turkey's non-cooperation with the U.S. Came about basically as a result of a technicality. The parliament actually voted in favor, but then there wasn't enough majority in the parliament at the time. So as a result of that, the vote was not valid. And I think, but the population at large was very much opposed to the idea. And they were opposed to the idea because being close to the region, being close to Iraq, being familiar with the history of Iraq, people could see that this wasn't a very wise move at the time. And for Turkey, getting involved in a war like that would really put a lot of issues in the country in a very dangerous place. So I think you could almost call it an instinctive reaction and not going along with this. Paul Wolfowitz is very familiar with Turkey in some ways, but I think his expectations about how the war would come out and what the result of this war would be, I think also showed that he wasn't as familiar as he could have been about the region, about the results of this war. So that's, I think, right now in Turkey, in terms of in Turkey's internal politics, there are groups who would support more of a closer relationship with the U.S. because it's precisely seen in some sense, as an antidote to all the changes and these liberties that would come as a result of closer alliance with Europe. And these are the conservative groups. These are parts of the military in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And that split, I think, is seen quite clearly among Turkish circles in the country.
And also, I think one major concern on that Iraq issue of many a Turk was the fact that, Iraq was as our neighbor, and we'd have to live with Iraq forever. Whereas America might come in and then pull out, and also the fact that there were prior to the first Gulf War very important trade between Turkey and Iraq which stopped after the war. And although I think America at the time had promised that, yes, Turkey would be compensated, they didn't.
Yes.
And so the feeling was that, well, why should we, put our, yes, nose into this hotbed,
yes,
once more and get into trouble when we're going to receive nothing in return?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with someone else. Here we have another caller. This is someone in Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I tuned in late, so you might have touched on this earlier. I wanted to bring up something about the popular opinion in Turkey and, in a sense, how it's reflected in this movie that seems to be very popular in Turkey and which is based on a series of books dealing with American conflict with Turkey. I'm sure you're familiar with the movie and with the books in which America is portrayed, very brutally. And if I remember correctly, the most recent volume of the book portrays a nuclear war involving Israel, America, and Turkey. Are you familiar with the series I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So I wanted to see how the popularity of these books and these themes, the anti-Americanism, the anti-Semitism, the various other themes that are in these books and their popularity in the Turkish media and in Turkey in general, what does that reflect? And what would you say about that, especially given the relationship that you've been talking about between Turkey and the United States and also Turkey and Israel?
I think it is true that there is a popular, what you could call, anti-American sentiment in Turkey, but not only in Turkey, in many parts of the world. But I think it is very important to understand that this is directed almost exclusively towards the policies of the U.S. government in Iraq, specifically in Iraq, and nothing else. And it is amazing how these sentiments change. There are streets in Ankara named after American presidents, and there's been American presidents when they come to Turkey. They've been greeted as almost like rock stars in
Clinton,
the past.
Clinton, for example,
yes,
yeah.
And continues to be very popular. So, but it is true that as a result of the war in Iraq, and I must also add that, again, being very close to Iraq, being a neighbor of Iraq and being directly influenced by what's going on there and being sort of witnessing in close range about the impact of that war. And it is not just the war itself in terms of the destruction and the bombing, but also the human cost of what's going on in the country. And regardless of which part, the insurgents or the U.S. government or the allies are inflicting the damage. And that, I think, is is causing a sentiment, anti-American sentiment in the country. And the films and the series that you've mentioned reflect that. And some are done better than others, and it is just it sort of speaks to what people, you know, maybe instinctively feel and what they want to read about, and it does reflect the general sentiment. But I wouldn't see it. I wouldn't think of it as a deep seated kind of resentment against America as such. It is more a reaction to, I think, the policies, mm-hmm. especially the war in Iraq, that's causing many of these.
And also, of course, this film, I haven't seen it, but it has been criticized heavily in the press and the media for what it shows, apparently. And many people have pointed out that, it is a reaction to this older film about Turkey, Midnight Express.
Uh-huh.
And mm-hmm. secondly, mm-hmm. that it's a reaction to this incident some time ago about Turkish soldiers being hooded and so on, Turkish officers in Iraq being hooded by American by the American army. But at the same time, there's much discussion about this film in terms of this rising nationalist fervor in Turkey that, Reşat, you were talking about a moment ago. In other words, as a result of the whole EU process, and partially as a result of some sectors of the European public having these negative attitudes about Turks and so on, the nationalist right seems to be on the rise, unfortunately. And by nationalist right, I should qualify that because this is a strange coalition of former ultra-left with former ultra-right, plus the social democrats, part of the social democrats in between and so on, who are very much upset about how European Union is treating Turkey. They're upset about the Cyprus issue and that the present government is trying to solve it, and so on. So it is an anti-EU, anti-liberal, liberal democratic coalition. And I think some of these books, as well as this movie, is an outcome of all of that as well.
Yes. But can I, if I could just sort of build on something that I asked but wasn't touched, what you didn't respond to. What about the geo-global strategic issues having to do between Israel and Turkey in terms of the region, in terms of counterbalances towards their own, neighbors? Maybe you could talk a little about that, since that's both in the Valley of the Wolves, which is the movie, and in also the books that the movie is based on, which actually book 2 and 3, as I said, go to nuclear war and invasions and so on and so forth. I don't know. I don't think they're in English yet, but I know they're in Turkish.
I guess there's no doubt that the majority of the Turkish people side with Palestine on that Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I don't think one could call it anti-Semitism, but there is definitely an anti-Zionist, anti-Israel feeling in Turkey on the part of the population. Whereas when you look at government policy, it has been pro-Israel since the beginning, actually.
Turkey was one of the, I think, the first or second country to recognize Israel.
Yeah.
And partly as a result of how the former Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire separated from the Ottoman Empire during World War I, there was, especially in the early years of the Republic, almost an instinctive sort of resistance of Arab politics, wanting to keep away from what's going on in the Arab countries. So Israel was seen as a useful ally and balance in that relationship. And throughout the history of modern Turkey, Turkey and Israel have had a very close relation, and they continue to. And, of course, Turkey, the Ottoman Empire, but Turkey also has a Jewish population, and some of these people have moved now to Israel, but they keep their Turkish citizenship. So I wouldn't really think of a deep-seated anti-Semitism as a characteristic of Turkish people.
No.
But there is, as Binaz mentioned, most people side with Palestine, but that is as a result, again, of being very close to the region and seeing some injustices in that, how that relationship has evolved over mm-hmm. the years. And that is a reaction to that. And the way these themes are used, I think, in these books and films, right, like all similar literature in this country, in Europe, they take some extremes of sentiments and they use them as a way of, you know, selling themes, selling books, selling stories. And this is done by people who are part of this extreme nationalist groups and ideologies that Binaz was talking about. But I, again, like the anti-Americanism, I wouldn't really think of this as something that reflects the overall general sentiment of Turkish people.
No American was attacked, for example, you know, in Turkey.
Yeah.
So definitely not.
Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. We have 7-8 minutes left, and I do also, for again, for anybody who might have tuned in the last 15-20 minutes, would like to again introduce the guests. Rajat Kasaba, he's professor in the Jackson School of International Studies at the University of Washington, and Binaz Toprak, professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul. They're both visiting here to take part in a symposium on Turkey on the U of I campus. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There is another story I wanted to ask you about that did get some coverage here in the United States and in Europe, I'm sure, and that has to do with the Turkish writer Orhan Pamuk, very popular in Turkey and someone who has now begun to be well-known, I think, outside of Turkey, particularly his last couple of novels. I know we're translating it to English, and I read them, and I thought that he's certainly a great writer.
Yeah, they were on New York Times. Bestseller.
Yes, people are definitely Snow and My Name is Red, where they sold a lot of books, probably unusual, I imagine, for a Turkish writer. And he got into trouble for comments he made in an interview concerning the Armenian genocide and was charged with insulting Turkishness. It did get attention outside of the country. It seems to me this is one of those cases that where there's an intersection of things like reform and free speech and Turkish identity all sort of come together. Mm-hmm. If merely saying something like that would be enough to land you in court. Now, the case was against him was dropped, perhaps just because people in Turkey thought it was directing a lot of unfavorable attention to Turkey, and probably some people thought this was best that we just get rid of this.
No, but not just that, because there are enough people inside the country, too, who are seriously, very seriously committed to consolidating liberal ideas and democratic ideas in Turkey. You know, the educated intelligentsia, for example, as well as the present party in government in many ways. So I don't think it was just the outside influence. Sure, that helped, you know, yes. The fact that he got international influence. But more so, there was so much criticism inside the country, you know, petition after petition being signed and then reported in the media and the press against the court's decision. So I don't think, you know, you can attribute the reaction only to this, fear of foreigners and what they would have to say.
I think all nations have some taboos that they feel uncomfortable talking about, and this is a very important issue. Was a very important issue in the formation of Turkish national ideology or identity. But I think it's a reflection of changes in the country that several months ago, actually, there was a conference for the first time in Istanbul, where the Armenian issue was discussed in detail, including the themes organized by Binaz University, and including issues that have to do whether this was a genocide and who was responsible, what was the Turkish responsibility was discussed thoroughly and openly. And there were people who were very unhappy about this, of course. They tried to prevent it They tried to block it. But the conference went on, and nothing happened. You know, I mean, that was just a very important turn of events. And the other thing I want to add is Orhan Pamuk's problems also had to do with the technicality of having a whole new set of laws, which in a way freed a lot of things that used to be forbidden, but at the same time left some loopholes that made it possible for some district attorneys to bring charges by using some forgotten codes and laws somewhere. And then once those charges are brought, of course, the courts have to deal with them. And I think there was an issue like that. But again, it is a manifestation of this ongoing conflict and change and groups within Turkey who are very resistant about some of the implications of these changes. And that's what we were seeing, I think, there.
And I think judiciary, unfortunately, is one of them. I mean, it's a small detail, but in this case, in Orhan Pamuk's case, as well as in the Armenian Conference mm-hmm. case, it is the single court in mm-hmm. Istanbul, one single court and one single civil society organization of lawyers, of a group of lawyers, you know, not the Bar Association or anything of the kind. Ultranationalist lawyers who take these cases to court. They took my university to court, for example. And this judge at court seems in every single case to have a very conservative position on these issues. I mean, everybody knew that that issue would come to nothing, you know. And after all, we did hold the conference, although it was postponed on the basis of this court decision for one day, and then the next day we sort of disregarded it and held it at some other university, which is a private one, not a public one, over which the court had no jurisdiction, basically. But so, you know, what I'm trying to say is that, and I mentioned that earlier, it's one thing to sort of change legislation favorably to fit the Copenhagen criteria, European Union criteria. It's another thing, of course, to implement them immediately. It's the same about women's issues. There's very serious problems concerning women in Turkey, the most important of which is honor killings in the southeast, especially the Kurdish region. But how do you get rid of them by changing legislation? You know, you can't. This takes time. And I think, you know, these cases are also similar in the following sense that, after all, it is up to the judge to interpret the legislation. And as most legislation goes, you can interpret it in both ways. And unfortunately, this particular court and judge has been interpreting it you know, negatively.
I want to try very quickly. We have one more caller here. Would like to get them in. Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Say, earlier caller mentioned about anti-American and feelings in Turkey. And you mentioned the Iraq War is a big issue there. Does anyone in the region feel that it's a good thing that we got rid of Saddam Hussein, that he was such a brutal dictator? Don't any of the Muslims in the area feel that even though the Iraq War has turned out terrible and I'm not in favor of it at all, but don't they feel that that's a good thing to get rid of a person like that?
Yeah, like I said, that's a good question, and I can give you maybe about a minute and a half here to make some response.
Yes. Well, very briefly, obviously, the Iranian government is very happy that Saddam Hussein is gone, which really meant that Iran's influence in the region has expanded tremendously and will continue to expand. But that is one element. And I think there were a lot of people, intellectuals, middle-class people, and people who suffered under Saddam Hussein himself. He was one of the worst brutal dictators in the country, that he is gone. But I'm not sure, again, for those people, this is, again, probably subject of a whole other program, but I don't think that they feel that what came in its place, the chaos, the uncertainty, the destruction, mm-hmm. is really something that was really worth the war. But as I said, I mean, this is really a big subject, and I think it should probably be a subject.
And also I think, you know, even though you might be against Saddam, you still, you know, don't necessarily have to approve a foreign force getting rid of them. So I think the feeling was that it should have been up to the Iraqi people to get rid of Saddam, and they would have at some point, hopefully.
There was so much more that I wish that we could talk about, and unfortunately we're down to the point where we pretty much have to finish. Is there something that you can say very, very quickly, like in about a minute, about Islam as a political force in Turkey? Now, Turkey is a country that officially is a secular nation, but it is also 98% Muslim, and like a lot of other countries in the region, I'm sure has to deal with the growth of a militant or at least a more vocal kind of Islam.
Oh, no, not militant. I mean, you know, that's what I've been trying to say. Look at this present party, for example. Pro-Europe, pro-democracy, pro-consolidating liberalism, market economy, and so on. And where it stands, I think militant Islam is a real freak case in Turkey, real marginal. There have been groups, and there are groups, but they never made any headway. And I think political Islam itself, maybe you want to add to that.
All I want to say
has been very moderate.
Yeah, I mean, all I want to say is it shows, I think, what is going on in Turkey shows that when we talk about political Islam, it's a diverse spectrum of groups and movements. And Turkey is a very good example of this. With enough openings and democratic procedures, I think the groups that are in power now are much more in tune with the sentiments of Turkish people in terms of being Muslims and basically socially perhaps conservative in some ways, but also very much open to what's going on in the world and what's going on in the region.
We're going to have to stop there with our thanks to Rashad Kasaba from the Jackson School of International Studies, University of Washington, and Binoz Toprak from the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Mogadishu University in Istanbul. They're here for the second Turkish Studies Symposium taking place on the campus, sponsored by the folks in South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.